In the next hour on Morning Ireland, multiple failures, legal uncertainty, devastating consequences. We'll talk to the HSE's safety chief and ask him if the lessons from the death of a 31-year-old miscarrying dentist have been learnt and won't happen again. Minister Richard Bruton on EU-US trade talks. Fianna Fáil up again, a lukewarm welcome to a chance to scrap the Shannon. Sean Donnelly on the latest opinion polls. Doubling up in a Cork prison, medieval banquets, and in sport, how a young Irish amateur golfer stormed day one at the US Open.
It's 8 o'clock on Friday, June 14th. You're listening to Morning Ireland on RT Radio 1 with Gavin Jennings and Fran McNulty.
The headlines: the White House has said the United States will provide direct military support to the rebels in Syria because government forces have been using chemical weapons. Gardaí in Dublin have issued an appeal for information on the sexual assault of a woman who has special needs. And the government has been asked to extend the limit at which businesses can appeal refusals for credit. Susan Jackson has the news in detail.
The United States has accused the Syrian government of using chemical weapons, including the nerve agent sarin, against its opponents. President Obama has now decided to provide more military support to the opposition in Syria, but it's not yet clear if this will include the supply of guns. Ben Rhodes, the US Deputy National Security Advisor, said the use of chemical weapons was a violation of international law.
The intelligence community estimates that 100 to 150 people have died from detected chemical weapons attacks in Syria to date. This is clearly a small portion of the catastrophic loss of life in Syria that now totals more than 90,000 deaths. But as we've consistently said, the use of chemical weapons violates international norms and crosses red lines that have existed in the international community for decades.
Gardaí have issued an appeal for information as part of their investigation into the serious sexual assault in Dublin 2 days ago of a woman who has special needs. The woman, who's in her 20s, was assaulted in the South Circular Road area on Wednesday afternoon. Our crime correspondent, Paul Reynolds.
Gardaí at Kevin Street in Dublin say they're treating this matter extremely seriously. The woman was with a member of her family on Dublin's South Circular Road around the Harrington Street, Leonard's Corner area on Wednesday afternoon. She became separated from the person she was with, and when she returned later in a distressed state, the Gardaí were alerted. Detectives believe the victim, who was vulnerable and has special needs, was taken into a house in the area where she was sexually assaulted. Gardaí have issued an appeal for anyone who may have seen the victim or anything unusual or suspicious on the South Circular Road between 3:30 and 5:00 on Wednesday afternoon to contact them.
A plan aimed at encouraging business and boosting jobs in Limerick will be announced by government ministers this morning. Limerick 2030 is aimed at transforming the city over the next 2 decades. The initiative will seek to reverse the decline in economic investment and retail sales. In another development for Limerick, more than 140 jobs are to be generated with the building of a fuel plant at Foynesport. Our Midwest correspondent, Cathy Halloran.
Limerick 2030, to be launched later this morning, is being described as a once-in-a-generation plan, which, if implemented, will completely transform Limerick city centre. The Arthur's Quay Park area is to be redeveloped, and the city's tax office at Sarsfield House is to be demolished to make way for a new city centre plaza, all linking with the Shannon Riverfront. The aim of the plan is to reposition Limerick city centre as the main shopping area of the region and to attract jobs and to locate innovation centres for start-up businesses and third level education. And new investment is on its way to the port of Foynes in Limerick. CPL, one of the biggest manufacturers of smokeless fuels in Europe, is to invest €20 million building a new biofuels plant with the creation of 142 jobs by 2015. The company is capitalising on the intention by the government here and in Northern Ireland to become the first country in Europe to ban smoky coal by 2016. Cathy Halloran, RTE News, Limerick.
Sinn Féin has said it would be a serious breach of party rules for any TD to vote against the party position on the forthcoming abortion legislation. The party's leader, Gerry Adams, said the Protection of Life During Pregnancy Bill was currently being considered and that a decision would be made in the coming days. Speaking on primetime last night, the Sinn Féin TD, Padraig Tobin, declared how he would be voting.
I'll be voting against this legislation, I have to say. It's with great difficulty that I'm voting against it, but for me, it's an impossible ask. For me, this legislation is a radical change from what's currently there.
The man charged with reviewing refusals for credit by the main banks has called for an increase in the upper threshold for appeals from €500,000 to €3 million. In his 11th report, John Throthone reports a 56% success rate for appeals for credit refusals. Here's Brian Finn of our business staff.
John Throthone was given the task by the government of reviewing credit refusals to small and medium businesses by the main banks 3 years ago. Initially, there was a low uptake for the credit review office's services, but in the past year, there's been a surge in requests as awareness of the CRO's existence increases. In his 11th report this morning, John Throthone calls on the government to extend the limit at which SMEs can appeal refusals for credit from €500,000 to €3 million. One third of lending to SMEs in the first quarter was categorised as new lending, he says. The two main pillar banks are currently sanctioned with providing €4 billion each in SME finance annually. John Trethowen said if this was all new financing, it would lead to a return to what he called the crazy lending patterns that got the country into difficulty in the first place.
And the time now is 6 minutes past eight.
7 minutes past eight, here again with It Says in the Papers, is Deirdre Purcell.
The Irish Times and Irish Examiner lead this morning with that report into the death of Savita Halappanavar. In the Irish Times lead, we're told that Professor Sabaratna Arulkumaran, who headed the inquiry, said that if she had been his patient in the UK, he would have performed a termination earlier in order to counter the risk of sepsis. The writer of the main editorial in The Examiner is contrasting the passion lavished on the unborn with the actual treatment of many children who live in our world, and concludes the piece with this: it may be too much to hope that the Protection of Life During Pregnancy Bill will bring an end to all this dishonesty and double standards. Let's hope it does. The other big story running this morning is the marine tragedy in Tremor Bay, which claimed the lives of three brothers, Kenny, Shane and Paul Bulger. In The Examiner, we're told that the trio would normally have gone out fishing in two boats along with another brother, Anthony, but he had had a heart bypass recently and so the three took to the one boat. The Irish Daily Star headlines this angle in its lead story, speculating that if it hadn't been for this heart operation, this fourth brother could have died with his three siblings. The Irish Independent leads with the headline Coalition's €6 billion gamble. Donal O'Donovan writes that the government is smashing open the state savings in an all or nothing gamble at kickstarting the economy. The pension reserve fund is being wound up and the money will be put into a new Ireland strategic investment fund, the ISIF, to be used for road and school building projects and water infrastructure. In the Times business section, we're told that yesterday, the use of offshore companies by companies such as Apple, Starbucks, Google and Amazon to avoid billions of dollars in US taxes came under scrutiny again on Capitol Hill. Edward Kleinbart, professor of law at the University of Southern California, told the influential House of Representatives Ways and Means Committee that Apple's Irish holding company, which warehoused profits made from international sales outside America, is a meaningless operation. On its front page, the Examiner's Sean Connolly tells us that ministers have told the Troika about how they will let banks off the leash to repossess homes. The Independent tells us that Irish concerns about cyber surveillance by US agencies were raised yesterday in a meeting between Alan Shatter and the US Attorney General Eric Holder. And in that context, the Times runs a full-page advertisement signed by eight international civil rights organisations, including the American Civil Liberties Union, the Irish Council for Civil Liberties and the Association for Civil Rights in Israel. It calls on the US to comply with international obligations and end its extraordinary intrusion into the lives of billions around the world. So what else? The Law Society's Justice Media Awards were handed out yesterday. Kitty Holland of The Times won the top award for her series of pieces on the death of Savita Halappanavar. And close to this studio, Vivian Traynor won the Court Reporting Broadcasting category, with Richard Dowling winning the National Radio Award. In news of more HSE cutbacks, the Star tells us that Thomas Lister, an amputee as a result of complications from diabetes, has been refused a grant for a stair lift to get upstairs to his bedroom and is sleeping on a couch. He was also refused the cost of a seat in his shower. No cutbacks in Mountjoy Prison, where many of the papers tell us that profits at the tuck shop at Mountjoy Prison have increased by 17% from more than €106,000 to more than €124,000. Turnover is more than €1 million on sales of cigarettes, sweets, crisps and cosmetics and, yes, newspapers. In pictures, Michael McSweeney has taken a shot of a conga line formed in the quad of UCC yesterday by graduates in speech and language therapy. What is striking is that they're all women. And finally, on the back page of the Examiner, we're told that police in Louisiana pulled over a pickup truck being driven recklessly on a motorway. They found a 10-year-old boy at the wheel with two women, one his grandmother, as passengers. They told him they asked the boy to drive because they were drunk.
Morning, Ireland. It's 14 minutes past eight. Last October, 31-year-old dentist Savita Halappanavar was admitted to Galway's University Hospital miscarrying a 17-week pregnancy and in pain. Within days, she was dead. Her husband said that they had asked for the pregnancy to be terminated and were refused. Praveen Halappanavar believed a termination would have saved her life. A coroner's inquest found she died from sepsis. Yesterday, a health service review into her death found a lack of recognition of the gravity of the situation and the increasing risk to the life of the mother, leading to passive approaches and delays in aggressive treatment, that not all management options were offered, and an overemphasis on the need not to intervene until a fetal heartbeat had stopped. Lots of recommendations in the report to try and make sure that mistakes like these aren't repeated, and we'll be talking to the HSE's National Director of Quality and Patient Safety in a moment. But earlier we talked to Sheila O'Connor from the patient advocacy group Patient Focus.
I think the patient culturally has been an outsider within the healthcare system, and that this is a culture, it takes an incredibly long time to change. And I think that explains the variability around the country in the willingness of hospitals and professionals to engage with patients and their families when injury occurs. And, you know, so the change is variable and sporadic and very uneven. So it is definitely there. Like 10 years ago, none of this would have happened, Gavin. So I'm not saying that that this is dreadful or that there's no improvement or that there aren't good people with serious intent to improve things. But we have a very long way to go.
And that was Sheila O'Connor from Patient Focus speaking to earlier Philip Crowley from the HSC. Dr. Philip Crowley, the HSC's National Director of Quality and Patient Safety, is with us in our studio. Philip Crowley, thank you very much for coming in.
Good morning, Gavin.
How reassured can the women of Ireland be that the mistakes made in Galway University Hospital won't be repeated there or in hospitals across the country?
Well, I think it behoves me in starting the interview to unreservedly apologise again to the husband and family of Savita Halappanavar after their very, very tragic loss. This is an event that should not have happened. My job, as you say, I'm National Director for Quality and Patient Safety in the HSE, and in relation to incidents of this nature, my job is to ensure that we robustly investigate an incident of this gravity, that we extract learning from that investigation, that we create clear recommendations, and that we implement those recommendations. So I suppose in answer to your question, what I can reassure you of and your listeners of really is that we will implement these recommendations in full. We already have a team in place to do so under the leadership of Michael Turner, who's the National Director for the Clinical Care Programme in Obstetrics. A number of the recommendations had already been underway for some time, such as the maternity early warning score, which is now implemented in all 19 maternity units around the country. And I think that will help. But I think we need training around the management of sepsis. We need to improve our record keeping. We need to implement all the recommendations of this report, and we will.
Why did it take the death of a 31-year-old woman to remind doctors, nurses, hospitals that basics like taking the temperature and the pulse of a patient who might be an infective risk need to be done on a regular basis?
I think that's a fair question, and I think what the report demonstrates is that that is exactly what fell down in this case. What we have put in place, first of all, what Galway have done in relation to the interim recommendations that Professor Sir Aral Kumaran put to them last November, is they have implemented a number of recommendations already around reminding staff of the importance of the monitoring of patients in a very detailed way if any of those parameters are starting to go off. I think it's what Professor Arakumaran pointed out yesterday in the press conference, and he would be an expert in this field, is that what occurred in Galway is a rare occurrence, and clearly the staff did not recognise what was happening, and therefore the acuity and the regularity of checking the patient.
Just to
was
be
not
clear,
adequate.
In case there's not, there is confusion on this, when you say it was a rare occurrence, it's a rare occurrence for a pregnant woman to die of sepsis, but
yes,
it would be a very rare occurrence for a pregnant woman with an infection of any sort to be allowed to proceed to sepsis because nothing was done to stop it.
Well, I think the problem was, as the report highlights, is that they didn't realise what they were dealing with. It was not clear to them that this woman was moving into sepsis. Sepsis, as you rightly point out, is an extremely serious condition. Septic shock is an even more serious condition.
But in theory, any infection could result in sepsis if intervention is not done.
Yes, that's true. Some infections will be far more likely to result in sepsis than others.
So what lessons have been... Again, I mean, this isn't just pertaining to people who are pregnant. I mean, any patient with any infective risk, anybody who walked into a hospital with an open wound, or in this case, membranes ruptured, would expect a certain standard of care. It didn't seem to exist in this case.
It did not happen in this case, no. And I think overall, the issue of sepsis is becoming far more important and critical, because we have a situation where, with maybe an overuse of antibiotics, we have more resistant organisms. We have people in hospital now who are sicker than previously, and I think we have a situation where sepsis is becoming more common. So I think as a health service, we need to redouble our efforts to train people in the recognition and very aggressive management of sepsis, and that is what we are going to do.
You're I'll just get your title again, National Director of Quality and Patient Safety. The patient safety bit I just want to focus on for a minute.
Sure.
Have you further questions that you want answered as a result of the death of Savita Halappanavar, particularly in relation to staffing levels at the hospital during the week in which this happened?
Yeah, this came up at the press conference yesterday, and I think it's fair to say the answers were not available to the press conference yesterday.
Why not?
Because the clinical director couldn't say with absolute certainty what the situation was. I have since checked with the hospital, and I can tell you for sure that no consultant obstetrician was on leave at that time. The hospital have assessed the staffing levels on the wards that Savita was cared for, and they were normal levels of staffing, adequate levels of staffing.
Safe levels of staffing?
I think safe levels of staffing, that was their analysis,
yes. Is that something that HICWA will investigate, or are you content to leave it at that?
Well, I think that the hospital have assessed that, and they've reassured me of that. I'll be very open to HICWA's analysis of that.
Just one final question. Some of the concerns raised by the chairman of this report in the news conference and in subsequent interviews yesterday, that the proposed changes to the law regarding abortion may have still made a situation like this very difficult, particularly when to intervene and the threshold of a real and substantive risk to the life of the mother. Again, you're in charge of patient safety at the HSC. Would you share his concerns?
Yes, I think it's a complex situation. I wouldn't comment on legislation, but I can say that what's critical, and I think what the chair highlighted as being critical yesterday, is that we had very clear clinical guidance. No matter what law is passed by the Oireachtas, we will need clear clinical guidance as to how to apply that law intelligently and safely and carefully in the care of a whole myriad of different clinical situations, and that guidance will be developed in Ireland.
Philip Crowley, National Director of Quality and Patient Safety at the HSE. Thank you very much for coming into us this morning. It's 22 minutes past 8.
The biggest challenge for the Irish EU presidency is agreeing a mandate for talks to begin on an EU-US trade deal. Discussions are underway on the issue as we speak in Luxembourg, being led by Jobs, Enterprise and Innovation Minister Richard Bruton. The deal could be hugely beneficial for the EU, but there are difficulties too. A huge stumbling block is the film industry in France. It has raised issues over the threat of American mass market entertainment to European culture. Funding provisions need protection too, say the French. I've been speaking to Minister Bruton this morning, and he has conceded that reaching agreement today will be tough.
There are a lot of national interests here, which are people are clinging to certain areas where they don't want certain items on the agenda. But the other side of this, it's a huge opportunity. I mean, it's been estimated as worth up to 100 billion extra in GDP or 400,000 extra jobs in the EU. So that's a very significant opportunity. So while some countries are nervous about in their industry being open to competition that they feel would threaten it, I think most member states recognise the great opportunity.
Have you measured what the potential impact in this country could be?
Well, even on a proportionate basis, you're talking about 4,000 additional jobs at least. But I think with our traditional connections to the US, we could do a great deal more. Clearly, even in areas like food processing, an area where there's a lot of protection in the US, that's an area where Ireland, as you know, has plans to increase its exports by 40%. So there's real opportunity in a market where we've been locked out traditionally.
On that particular issue, there has been significant concern expressed about not exportation, but the potential importation impacts on the agriculture and food production industry here. What sort of safeguards or measures will be possible in any potential trade talks that could protect industry here?
Well, in all of these cases, you start negotiations, and you know we see our opportunities. Obviously, the US will come hoping to open up markets. In other agreements, you know, limits have been put on the extent to which markets can be opened. That has been the approach in the negotiations on Canada. So you seek to open up markets. I mean, we're locked out completely from dairy sector in the likes of Canada, and similar provisions apply in the US where the barriers are very high. So we seek to get in, but obviously we seek to defend other interests, particularly premium cuts in beef would be an area where we'd have defensive interests as they describe them. But the bottom line is you're trying to open up opportunities for trade. But we need to today agree an agenda for those talks and then move rapidly into talks which are hoped to be concluded over the next 14 or 15 months.
The Taoiseach announced yesterday you had been appointed Director of Elections for the Shannon vote. An opinion poll out yesterday evening showing 52% in favour, 34% against and 14% undecided. Not exactly the endorsement of Shannon abolition you'd have hoped for.
Well, I believe we've a very simple and strong proposition to put to the people, and the campaign hasn't even started. Our proposition is, do you want fewer politicians to manage Ireland's affairs? I'm convinced that we can, like every other small developed country, manage with one parliament. It shows that politics is willing to make sacrifices, just like every other family in the country has had to make sacrifices. And, you know, for 50 years we've been talking about reforming this body and trying to find some purpose. 10 reports on reform and not one of them acted upon. You know, I think people will support this approach.
That's Minister Richard Bruton speaking to me from Luxembourg earlier this morning. Well, that Red Sea poll on the Shannon vote wasn't the only poll detail released this week. This morning, an Irish Times Ipsos MRBI poll puts Fianna Fáil at 26% unchanged, Fine Gael down 1 at 24, Sinn Féin up 3 at 21, and Labour down 1 to just 9%. Political analyst Sean Donnelly is with us now. Sean Donnelly, to that Shannon vote first, or that Shannon poll first, Richard Bruton puts it quite simply, do you want fewer politicians? The public doesn't appear to buy that. Are you surprised?
Very surprised, most surprised. I mean, it's about a 60, when you step out the underside, it's about 60% yes vote, which is very, very low. I mean, I would have thought it'd be up around the judges' pay referendum, which we had in 2011, which was 80% yes vote. You go back to changing the voting age to 18 back in 1972, there was an 85% yes vote. The Northern Ireland Agreement in 1998, 94% yes vote. I thought it would be up in sort of those levels. And to be down around 60% is very, very surprising. And that's not unbreachable either, because it's not a 20% gap. It's 10% of the people moving from one side to the other, and you're into a contest.
Is it easily explained?
No, it's not. It's surprising. I mean, I would have thought, but like the judges' pay, it would be a resounding yes vote. And maybe people haven't had time to switch on to it yet. It's early days. There's been no real campaign about it. But I think there's a warning there for the government not to take it for granted, that just because it seems like, you know, that people would vote for it, it's not always the case.
Could it be an indicator of people's view of the government that, despite the fact they're recommending fewer politicians and something which many people are saying is good, that people just really aren't happy with anything that the government might propose?
Yeah, but I think in the Irish Times poll, the government satisfaction rating is actually up
yes.
this month, so that sort of contradicts that. I think maybe it's just a wee bit early in the campaign at this stage, but it's very, very surprising.
On those figures, as you say, I mean, relative good news for some parties. Overall, what would your take on the poll this morning?
I think there's been a lot of polls, and there's been two polls out in the last couple of days, contrasting polls. So I think if you look at the overall figure, I was looking, there was 22 polls, national polls published in 2012. And if you average the Fine Gael vote, it came out at 32%. There's been 16 polls so far this year, and that average is down to 26%. Similarly, Labour have gone from 14% average last year to 11%. Fianna Fáil have gone in the opposite direction from 17 to 25, with Sinn Féin remaining around the 18. So the trend is there. The government parties are going down. Fianna Fáil are going up, and Sinn Féin are staying up around the 18%. If you look at, compared the latest poll with the general election, which is, of course, the important date that we all have to look, keep in mind, and the Fine Gael vote is down 12 points, with Fianna Fáil up 9. The Labour vote is down 11, and that's the amount that the Sinn Féin vote is up. So that changes the whole dynamic for the next election. I mean, if you combine the two government parties, they're only on 33%. If you combine the two main opposition parties, Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin, they're on 47%.
There's another important date as well, and that's the local elections. And one would assume, looking at these figures, the Labour Party are very concerned about those elections.
And they have form here. I mean, this is a repeat of 1992 when they had their big day out. They won 33 seats with 19% of the vote under Dick Spring. But the next election, they were back down to earth, down to 10%, and remained there for three elections. So this trend now has started again. The big election last in 2011, now they seem to be around the 10%, and they've dropped into single figures actually in this latest poll. So worrying with the local elections on the horizon.
Just briefly, can Labour arrest this difficulty, this issue? Is it too late?
Well, Fianna Fáil found out that once you're down there, it's very, very difficult to get back up, especially when you're in government. Where's the good news going to come from? Someone to give you the boost, and that's the difficulty. And they found that the polls indicated after 92 that they were in trouble, and they never really recovered, and it took them right up until 2011 to get back out of that, around that 10% vote.
OK, political analyst Sean Donnelly, thanks for coming in to us this morning.
8.34, you're listening to Morning Ireland. Des Kahle is back with more sports news.
Yeah, and coming up, Gavin, we've Simon Zeebo, Kevin McStay, Michael Deignan. But we begin with golf, of course. The first round of the US Open didn't get finished because of a long delay, but there was plenty of excitement, as we can hear now from Greg Allen.
With more than 4 hours of rain and storm delays, day one still produced its share of stories, not least of which was Rory McIlroy looking something like his old self again, except for a late three-putt bogey on the 11th green, which dropped into level par. And that was just before play was suspended. And it leaves him four off the leader Luke Donald, who popped in his third birdie putt in a row on the 13th to get to 4-under. And he has a one-stroke advantage over two men on 3-under, Masters champion Adam Scott, who's played 11 holes, and Phil Mickelson, whose preparation for this US Open included not a single completed practice round this week. Then he had a journey back to California where he attended his daughter's 8th grade graduation, and then he had a 4-hour flight back here on Wednesday night, landing 3 hours before his 7 a.m. tee time before he shot a 3-under par 67, his joint lowest ever first day's return in his 23rd US Open.
It actually worked out really well. I got all my work done on Marion here when I was here a week and a half ago, so I didn't feel I needed more time at Marion. What I needed was to get my game sharp, to get my touch sharp. And having a nice practice facility and nice weather for the last couple of days allowed me to do that. So it worked out great on both ends.
For a long time, the 22-year-old Irish amateur international Kevin Phelan, who spent all his primary school years in his parents' home city of Waterford, was there or thereabouts in the top three on the leaderboard before he signed for a 1-over 71. That leaves him just 5 off the pace.
It's always nice to be able to compare yourself to the best in the world. It's the first time I've had a round anywhere close to them, so it's nice, but there's a long way to go. We'll just try and keep plodding along and do my best.
You played in the US Open 3 years ago as a 19-year-old.
Yeah, I probably learned more in that week than I have the rest of my golfing career combined. But that was a huge help for me today, just to stay patient and keep plodding along, even when I made a couple of mistakes. So that definitely served me well.
Phelan's round was two better than Paddy Carrington's 73, while resuming this morning here, Graeme McDowell is 3-over after 12, Darren Clarke 5-over after 14, while Tiger Woods, playing with McIlroy, is 2-over after 10, but he seems to be suffering from an apparent arm injury sustained while hitting out of heavy rough on the first hole. Play resumes at 12:15 Irish time.
That's Greg Allen. Now in rugby, desperate luck for the Irish under 20 team who just missed out on a place in the semi-finals of the Junior World Cup. Mike Ruddock's side lost narrowly to New Zealand in a thrilling match. It finished 31-26 for the All Blacks. We were camped on their line near the end, couldn't score. The ref, the Irish fans felt, could have been more nice fair to the Irish, yeah. But we missed out on the best runners-up spot in the semi-finals because South Africa beat France in a different pool. For the Irish senior game against Canada tomorrow, Munster centre James Downey wins his first cap. He'll partner Darren Cave in midfield. Andrew Trimble joins Fergus McFadden and Felix Jones in the back three. Ian Madigan again partners Isaac Boss at half-back. And up front, Tom Court comes into the front row. Dan Toohey the second row. Kevin McLaughlin and Tommy O'Donnell are into the back row. Meanwhile, the British and Irish Lions play the Waratahs tomorrow, and that sees a first start for Simon Zeebo, who was called up last weekend while touring the USA with the Irish team.
I was actually told straight after we played the States that I was going to go and join up with the squad down here. So yeah, it's pretty good. Michael Kearney, our team manager with the Irish team, told me, and I was just over the moon, handshakes and hugs all around, so it was a great day. But now just very much in the thick of it, and got over that, and just really exciting to get out there and playing some rugby.
And that's what it's all about now, really, taking the chance when it's presented, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. There's not many more chances before the test side is picked, and every player out here wants to be a part of the test team, and you just got to go out and put your best foot forward, and hopefully we'll start with a good win over a tough side tomorrow.
And good luck to Simon Zeebo. Now, let's look ahead to the weekend GAA action. And first of you on the football games with Kevin McStay. Good morning, Kevin.
Morning, Des.
You're off to Ockram tomorrow evening for Wicklow and Meath.
Yeah, first time out for me down in Ockram, I have to say. Really looking forward to it. But in the build-up to it, Des, both teams, outrageously contrasting league form. One, Wicklow heading to Division 4 from Division 3, Meath heading to Division 2 from Division 3. So on paper, it looks like Meath, and yet I think Wicklow have a perfect opportunity here. It's a great match for them. They're at home. They have a chance. Meath are still, you know, a big championship scalp, so they're not without hope. But you'd have to sense that Meath have a strong line out, a good team picked. If they play, they have the material, and should be Meath.
All right, then you're heading off to Enniskillen to join the G8 crowd as Fermanagh play Cavan.
If I ever get into the place, and when we do get there. This one is going to be, in my opinion, tight and tense. It could be a bit cynical as well because they have a bit of league form behind them. A lot of players sent off in that match. So, in my view, it would probably discipline would be a big part of it. It always is in Ulster Championships. And it could come down to free takers. And there you have Martin Dunn and Sean Quigley. And I'd give the vote to Quigley if I had to, as the better player. I'm expecting Fermanagh to win this game. Cavan have a poor record in Ulster recently. Haven't won two successive matches, Des, would you believe, since 2001. That's a long time ago. And the loss of Garrod McKernan now is huge to them, and I think they're going to feel it on Sunday.
Okay, and then Clare and Mick O'Dwyer trying to pull off a bit of a miracle against Cork.
And that's exactly what they're looking for, a miracle. And I just don't see it happening because the Cork players are essentially playing for their spots and their jerseys in the Munster final. So it'll be full out with them. They'll come with a good attitude. And if they do come with a good attitude, and they will, Cork will come with a good attitude. They have the quality, they have the athleticism. And even though Clare is home and the Mickle factor and his first championship in charge, they just have too much quality, Des. Mm. You have to say Cork. It has to be Cork.
And finally then, Mayo versus Roscommon Sunday afternoon.
Yeah. Yeah, an amazing build-up to this, and that, as you know, I live in the county, and the pessimism among Roscommon supporters is just amazing. I don't see it in reality, because I know a lot of the players. The team they've picked is very, very decent, and I think they will get within the spread. The spread is 5 points. I think they'll do better than that. And if Mayo were ahead of themselves in any way in terms of complacency, they'd be in trouble. But Mayo are an elite team now. We know that. They're well up there in the top four or five teams in the country. They have big, big ambitions. So if they're about their business, you'd expect a Mayo win.
All right, Kevin McStay, thanks a million. Enjoy your games at the weekend. Moving on to hurling, a couple of significant games in Leinster. And we're joined now by Offaly man Michael Dyke. Good morning, Michael.
Morning, Des.
Well, the Dublin-Wexford replay, first of all, tomorrow.
Yeah, you know, I was down there last Saturday in a fantastic atmosphere in Wexford Park. Dummy Wexford teams, we had blistering start from Dublin, but, you know, they lost their confidence completely. They were 6 points to one ahead, and just to watch the confidence seeping out of them after that was unbelievable. And Wexford, on the other hand, built in confidence as the game went on. And, you know, it looked like they had no self-belief, but they really came into the game and really should have won it. Indiscipline cost them. They gave away a lot of silly frees and could have had a couple of red cards even. So it was a very poor game down there, you know, when all the hype was taken away from it. The hurling was terrible. So I'm expecting a lot better this week. I think the game will stand to them. And with Conal Keeney gone back to the Dublin half-forward line now, Stephen Heine in his wing-back, Paul Ryan starting, you'd expect Dublin at home maybe just to have a little bit more than Wexford, but it's only a hunch after watching the game last Saturday evening, it could go either way.
Okay, now Laois at home to Galway. Galway, clearly a hot favourites there. What can Laois hope for in this one?
Well, I think they had a great win against Antrim the last day, and what I like about Laois this year is the way Seamus Plunkett, the manager from Port Laois, he's a Laois man, a proud Laois man. He's rebuilt the confidence and the pride in the jersey more than anything. So they're looking for a big display, a wholehearted display, a bit like Offaly against Kilkenny last Sunday, where, you know, really they had no chance, but they fought right down to the wire and played very, very well. But I think Galway lit up the championship last summer with their display in the Leinster final. It was definitely the display of the year, and they came up short in the end last year, but I think they have the potential to be thereabouts on the big days again this summer, and Galway will win that, and it'll be interesting to see how they fare over the summer.
Okay, and quick word on Down against Armagh in the Ulster quarter final. Down back out.
Yeah, Down out again after the great win last week, and you'd expect, expect Down to get the better of Armagh in that one.
Okay, Michael Dignan, thanks a million. He'll be with us in the Sunday game. In show jumping, great win for Team Ireland in the Canadian Nations Cup, and victory for Conor Swale, Dara Kearns, Richie Maloney and Cameron Hanley back from his injury. Usain Bolt won the 200 metres in Oslo last night in the fastest time of the year, 19.79 seconds. The Irish men's hockey team had an excellent 4-all draw with India in the World League in Rotterdam. In racing, Lettermore won the Ballycorra Stakes at Leopardstown for Jim Bulger and Kevin Manning, and will now serve as pacemaker for Dawn Approach at Royal Ascot. William McCreary took the Ballyogan Stakes with Fisolana, ridden by Colm O'Donoghue. Two race meetings this evening, Clonmel and Navan. And in soccer tonight, the league leader St Pat's go to Dundalk. Derry City travel to Bray Wanderers. It's Bowes versus Shelburne, Shamrock Rovers versus Limerick, and Cork City against Drogheda.
Des, thank you. We learned this morning that members of the Unite trade union have voted to reject the Haddington Road proposals by over 70%. The union finished its counting of ballots last night. Hardly surprising, given the union's strong recommendation urging members to oppose the deal. The executive described the measures as Haddington Road labels slapped onto a Croke Park bottle. The union's Jimmy Kelly is on the line. Good morning, Jimmy Kelly.
Good morning.
You urge your members to reject the deal. They've done so. What now?
Well, it was really a big ask, given the climate of pressure from the government on workers during these ballots. What we're going to do is, first of all, meet our public sector reps this morning to announce the ballot result, to assess exactly what we do next. We'll pend in further ballots that's taking place at the minute. The results of those will be announced over the coming week. And our representatives will assess what the best next steps are in the context of those ballots, whether they're rejected by a number of other unions, and where we then stand on what we need to do next. The freedom to have a ballot has been interfered with by the government from day one. The threat to punish people who vote against Haddington Road proposals is a disgrace, and all unions should be against what's been denied in terms of free collective bargaining,
right,
and the right of our members to reject these plans.
Having urged your members, Jimmy Kelly, to reject it, and them having done so, would it not have been prudent for you in the intervening period to have devised a plan as to what is next? Because the reality is the government is continuing to threat to legalise, to introduce legislation, to introduce pay cuts.
Well, you know, unions are entitled to the freedom of a ballot. And when workers get that ballot paper, they're entitled to reject or accept proposals. That's exactly the process that we've engaged in. And our members, on the basis of a recommendation from our public sector shop stewards, have decided to reject this. That's the freedom of having a ballot around a set of proposals. And Unite represents workers who will be subject to reductions in overtime rates, staffing numbers, roster reorganisation, outsourcing, which will reduce the rate of pay. A successful bidder in one particular regional hospital is employing people at €8.65, €8.65 per hour, while the rate for our workers is €15 per hour. So that's what we've rejected. And the Haddington Road proposals still cuts €1 billion out of the public sector. That is bad for the public sector. It's going to reduce jobs. And we're now in a position where we've rejected those, and are in a similar situation, and we'll see where we are when those ballots are completed across all the unions. There was a massive rejection of the original proposals in Croke Park too. That should have been taken by the trade union movement as a stand by public sector workers against any further cuts. And clearly the message across the public sector was enough is enough, and we're standing by our members on that basis.
Just in conclusion, I want to ask you about the rally which your union is taking part in Belfast at the weekend. Some concern has been expressed about whether it's prudent to organise such a gathering with the G8, the fact it could potentially be hijacked. Is it something you're intent on going ahead with?
Well, Unite is part of the Irish Hungers of Trade Unions organising of a festival of events over the next few days in terms of the G8 leaders coming to Ireland. And in fact, we had a rally last night in Belfast where Unite spokespersons, other union spokespersons, NIPSA, Unison, Mandate, kicked off the next number of days with events to demonstrate against leaders who are standing out for austerity across the world.
Is it a good idea to be organising it, given the fact that there are concerns that events like this could be hijacked by people who have a very different agenda to what trade unions might have?
Well, I think the media and security forces are building up that sort of a climate to try and dampen down the efforts of people to organise protests, which are legitimate.
Okay.
People are going to be proud to protest over the next few days. These leaders represent the worst aspects of austerity, represent attacks on people right across the world, in fact, and we want to be proud to demonstrate against them.
Okay, Jimmy Kelly of Unite, thank you for that. It's 10 to 9 now. Well, a question for you. What do Charles de Gaulle, Pope John Paul II, Princess Grace, Bob Hope, the Beatles, and all the Blacks rugby, and the All Blacks rugby team have in common? Well, they were all entertained by the Bunratty Castle Entertainers. Our reporter Petula Martin visited Bunratty and spoke to Castle Entertainers past and present as they celebrate 50 years of banqueting at Bunratty.
We welcome ye to Bunratty in Gaelic common voyage. With food and wine your cares will flee as we sing Camilla for a town.
It's one of Ireland's most successful tourism stories. The medieval banquet at Bunratty Castle in County Clare is 50 years old. The banquet was the brainchild of Brendan O'Regan, chairman of Shannon Development at the time. John Ruddle is CEO of Shannon Heritage.
Brendan O'Regan was a great visionary, and Brendan would have started the banquets, and there was trial banquets in 1962 where he brought staff, administrative staff out from Shannon Development who literally did the banquets at night time, and these trial banquets went on during 1962 to see could he come up with a formula that worked for the international tourism industry. And of course in 1963 the first commercial banquets were launched.
Good evening, my lady, you're very welcome.
It's here in the great dining hall of the castle that 2.5 million people have feasted at the banquet. Many of them were welcomed by Noel Murphy, who was a butler at Bunratty for 26 years.
There's a whole buzz of coming to a 500-year-old castle. They can't believe how authentic it is. They're charmed by the beauty of the ladies, the glamour of the gowns, the candle glow, the ambience, the smell of food cooking. And you could just see by their faces, you know, that they're just loving every minute of it.
In 1971, I was just finishing my leaving cert and applied for the job and joined the castles a week after finishing my leaving cert.
Deirdre Stevenson is now Senior Manager of Evening Entertainments.
It was a time when they really wanted to promote Ireland. So we were seen as sort of giving the story of Ireland through music and song and story through the entertainments that we provided here for the visitors and, of course, for people at home.
Sleiter is sale.
Phyllis Lippman from Mesquite, Nevada, USA.
You're drinking mead there. What does it taste like?
It tastes very sweet. I understand it's made of honey. And it's good. It's pretty good.
Is it potent?
It can be if you have enough.
And my name is Jean Dubay, and I live in St. Louis, Missouri. I'm looking just to see some Irish customs and the folklore and that kind of thing. I really like that.
The banquet was originally aimed at visitors from the United States, but for former butler Noel Murphy, it was the reaction of Irish guests that he enjoyed the most.
They probably grew up with the idea that this was a tourist-only kind of show, and that would be very Paddy Whackey and Phaethon Bigara and generally Derby O'Gill stuff. I assure you, it is far from that. It is a classy, wonderful, warm evening.
In 2008, there was a fall in visitor numbers, but CEO John Ruddle says it's picking up again.
Visitor numbers are quite good at the moment. Visitor numbers have grown this year by about 10% over last year, which is good news. And last year had grown about 5% over the year before. So thankfully, we're beginning to climb out of the difficulties that we had maybe 3 or 4 years ago when there was a big downturn in the tourism industry. And we're certainly finding that the gathering events, particularly around the local area here, are raising the numbers.
The banquet is also attracting tourists from the Asian market following a recent visitor. Deirdre Stevenson again.
The most recent, exciting visitor we had was President Xi Jinping, and that whole banquet especially for him. So that was a very exciting project for all of us. There's now some interest coming in from China. How exciting.
Will there be medieval banquets in Bunratty in 50 years' time?
I'm absolutely sure there will be. I'm not sure will it be exactly identical to what it's like today, but I do think that the formula that was put together in the very early days, which has held so well over 50 years, I've no doubt will continue for another 50.
John Ruddle, Shannon Heritage Chief Executive, ending Petula Martin's report. It's 5 to 9.
How many prisoners should any one prison cell? In Ireland, just under half of Irish prisoners have a cell to themselves, and new prisons are supposed to have one cell for every prisoner under European rules. But in Cork, where a new prison is being planned, prisoners will still have to double up. Father Peter McVerry of the Jesuit Centre is very critical, and he's on the phone now. Father McVerry, good morning to you.
Good morning, Gavin.
The Department of Justice, in response to your criticism, say, given the current number of prisoners in custody, 4,233 as of yesterday, the Irish Prison Service is not in a position to provide single-cell accommodation to all prisoners. It should be borne in mind that in some cases, prisoners are housed together for reasons other than lack of capacity. Family members, friends and co-accused prisoners often are assigned a shared cell. What would you have to say to that?
Well, first, I'd welcome the building of a new prison. Cork Prison is the worst prison in the system at the moment, and very much welcome it. However, it's one thing to have to double up prisoners in a case where there is a spike in prison numbers. However, what we're planning here is to have double cell occupancy. This prison is going to be used for the next 100 years at least, and we're building into the system double cell occupancy. The Mountjoy prison, which was the worst prison in the system, has been refurbished. Two of the landings now have been completed. It's single cell occupancy, and it's a totally different prison. It's going to become the model prison in the system. The prison officers will tell you it is a much, much more pleasant atmosphere to work in. The prisoners will tell you it's a much more pleasant place to live. The level of aggression and violence on those landings has dropped dramatically to almost nothing. So I think building into the system double cell occupancy is a retrograde step.
The Justice Department also say that the new cells in Cork will all have full cell insanitation. They will have showering facilities, will be fully compliant with the standards for double occupancy as set down by the Inspector of Prisons.
Can you imagine? That's very welcome, but can you imagine two people living in a cell together, two people usually not of their own choice, living in a cell together? I mean,
they're not in prison of their own choice either, Father McVerry, to be fair.
No, their companion in the cell is not of their own choice. Sometimes two people find it very hard to live in a house together, but can you imagine two people living in a cell 17 hours a day together? It creates a level of apprehension, a level of unpleasantness that I think can only lead to problems within the prison system. I think we should be planning to have single cell occupancy, and where it may be unfortunately necessary to double up, then we double up. But let's not plan for double cell occupancy.
Father Peter McVerry, thank you very much for speaking to us this morning. Almost 2 minutes to 9.